Hi, I'm Moji Alawodeyau from the Feminist Buzzkills Live Pod, the only podcast that helps you navigate the news in this post-pro anti-abortion hellscape. Each week, with co-host Liz Winstead, we dissect all the news from that sketchy intersection of abortion and misogyny with providers and activists working on the ground. The cherry on top is we have amazing comedy guests who help us laugh through the rage. Feminist Buzzkills Live drops Fridays wherever you pod. Listen and subscribe, because when BS is popping, we pop off.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations with Jeff Stein and Jean Meserve.
Welcome to Spy Talk. I'm Jean Meserve. Jeff Stein is off on medical leave. Illegal immigration has been one of the most toxic issues in American politics for decades, and there is no indication that is going to change. Republican Governor Greg Abbott of Texas has been sending busloads of migrants to New York City and Washington, D.C. Some dismiss it as a re-election stunt intended to generate publicity, but Abbott told Fox News the purpose is to give so-called sanctuary cities a taste of what Texas experiences every day.
Most of America has not really understood the magnitude of the problem that we have on the border until we started sending these buses up to New York. Remember, this is not a Texas problem. This is an American problem caused by the President of the United States of America.
Alan Berson has been immersed in the immigration issue for years, serving as the so-called border czar for the Department of Homeland Security and as head of Customs and Border Protection in the Obama administration. I asked him about the quality of the intelligence gathered on the southern border.
Human smuggling has transformed over the last 30 years. In the 1990s, when irregular, illegal migration first really got onto the screen of American politics in a way that has not stopped since. Most of the smuggling that was taking place was by so-called mom-and-pop operations. Kinds of cases that we saw on the U.S.-Mexico border were people bringing other people in two or three or four at a time, whether hidden in compartments and vehicles and tractor trailers, or being smuggled across the border between the ports of entry by coyotes. The amount of money that it took to get smuggled into the United States was a fraction of what it is today. What we've seen, because of the push factors out of countries and the pull factors into the United States, we've seen these numbers increase, so that we've moved from what was largely a Mexican migration issue from the 1960s through, let's say, 2015, when for the first time we saw Central American refugees become the problem of smuggling. And because you were dealing with countries that were not contiguous to the United States, that required more elaborate smuggling mechanisms to get people from Honduras and Guatemala, El Salvador, into the United States through Mexico, we saw an expansion of the smuggling rings and a change in the way in which they operated. And now, of course, we're seeing smuggling from all over the world, large numbers of people coming from the outside the Western Hemisphere, still from the Middle East and Asia. Many people in Africa continue to go to Europe, but more and more we're seeing large numbers of people being smuggled into the United States after having made a journey from the Eastern Hemisphere into South America, and then up through South America, through the Darien Gap, into Central America, and then through Mexico to the southwest border. Those logistics involve organizational capacity that is far different from what we saw a generation ago.
Bigger.
Much bigger, much more powerful. And as the costs of smuggling and the fees generated by smuggling increased, as they have dramatically, you began to see more and more of an interest of organized crime in getting involved in this. First, in the, over the last 10 years, in the those that controlled the approaches, the corridors into the United States, the so-called plazas, charging a fee to the smuggling, human smuggling groups and human trafficking groups, you're seeing much more now a direct involvement of transnational organized criminal groups in this enterprise.
When I see stories about the U.S. being surprised by, for instance, migrant caravans, our intelligence must not be very good if we are not seeing these huge groups of people heading our way.
We see them, but we lack the kind of intelligence that we would want to know in terms of how are the groups being generated, how are they being organized, how are they being financed. And on top of the issues we identified in the narcotics context, we have some very specific factors that have prevented a prioritization of this, that is a focus on intelligence gathering with regard to migration movement.
So it's just not been a priority?
It has not been a priority, notwithstanding the fact that every pronouncement talks about increasing the resources that will be devoted to taking down, end quote, human trafficking groups. And while there have been elements of improvement in the last 4 or 5 years as this problem has gotten on the screen, we're still nowhere near the capacity that we need to know where these groups are coming from, how they operate, and taking actions to disrupt them.
Is a wall going to solve the problem?
Absolutely not. Not only was Janet Napolitano right about show me a 50-foot wall and I'll show you a 51-foot ladder, but the fact of the matter is that the way in which people are brought to the United States really happens far away from the borderline. You know, often with regard to the drug problem and the migration problem, we focus on the borderline, la linea between the United States and Mexico. But in fact, in order to successfully counter these activities, we have to enlist time and space. We have to deal with them as far geographically as we can from the borderline, and as early before these illicit goods or irregular migrants arrive at the borderline.
Are we going to get that kind of cooperation from the countries involved? I wouldn't think some of them would have the capacity.
Well, certainly the Northern Triangle countries, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, lack the infrastructure. Mexico has cooperated more with regard to migration management, but not because their hearts, frankly, are in it, but rather, and one can understand that because of the presence of 11 million Mexican, undocumented Mexican migrants in the United States and the need from the Mexican government perspective to protect those people as best they can. But we have gotten cooperation either through real partnership, which we saw during the Obama administration and the Bush administration, but also because of, even in the context of the Trump administration, the threats that were made, the tariffs that were imposed, reminded the Mexicans something they never forget, which is the economic dependence of their country and their export trade on commercial relations with the United States. So that cooperation never as complete as it could be, obviously is not stopping the number of people that are arriving at the Southwest border. But that is, I think, pales in significance to the broken immigration system that we have. And the failure to enact comprehensive immigration reform in the last generation that has made the situation, exacerbated the situation, both in terms of providing incentives for people to travel in irregular fashion, as well as the willingness of undocumented parents, understandably so, and relatives in the United States to finance the smuggling of their relatives and children from the countries of origin.
I want to get to immigration reform in just a moment, but we've mentioned the economic drivers that send people north. A lot of them are just fleeing violence and persecution. There was an effort to try and provide aid to those countries to stabilize things to some degree. I believe it was cut off during the Trump administration. Is that effort back in full swing? And do you think it'll have a significant impact?
So there's no question that the root causes, the push factors, whether it's violence or poverty, lack of economic opportunity, natural disasters that make it increasingly difficult for people in Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador to remain in safe and humane conditions. There's no question that addressing those root causes are absolutely critical. The difficulty is that this is a 40-year phenomenon. The main deterrent that we saw, now actually lessening, but the main deterrent to Mexican migration that then led Central American migration to exceed Mexican migration was the growth in the Mexican economy that took place in the aftermath of the North American Free Trade Agreement. Mexico now has the 16th largest economy in the world. That was what made it possible for Mexicans to remain in their homeland. And we then saw the same problems driving Central Americans and other people from around the world toward the United States because of the obvious attractiveness of economic opportunity here, security here, and civil liberties here, at least for the moment.
Should we be doing more to improve their economies, to help them deal with natural disasters?
There's no question, but the question that arises both in the Obama administration when Vice President Biden was leading that effort and now when Vice President Harris is leading that effort is that we tend to approach this, Gene, in terms of incremental programmatic relief administered by the State Department and the Agency for International Development. And while those efforts are hard to criticize, they are laudable, they simply won't get the job done. They simply cannot, within a meaningful time frame, lead to changes in the situation that will stem irregular migration to the United States. You know, having said that, we need to change the nature of the programs, prioritize them, resource them better than we're doing, organize them in the country to address specific problems in a sequenced priority fashion, violence being one of them. How do you actually work with authorities in the Northern Triangle countries to bring down the level of violence? Same could be said for Mexico. But the larger issue is an economic one. And I've always believed from government days that the most effective way of dealing with the root causes is to do what we did in the case of Mexico, when Canada and the United States really connected very in path-breaking fashion back in the 1990s. To get the Mexican economy involved in the North American economy.
We're talking NAFTA.
That was NAFTA, continuing with USMCA, but we need to now extend the notion of North America for lots of reasons, but particularly with regard to this migration issue. We have to see the region of North America as really not just being the three core countries of Canada, Mexico, and the United States, but rather a region that extends from Colombia to the Arctic and from Bermuda in the Atlantic to Hawaii in the Pacific. And it starts to understand that the Caribbean Basin and Central America are parts of North America that have to be integrated into the quite remarkable shared production platform that now exists among Canada, the United States, and Mexico. Low-cost manufacturing that has been the maquiladoras on the U.S.-Mexican border, they actually need to be, the private sector needs to be helped by government to move those industries to the south, to the Mexico-Guatemala border, so that, in fact, people in those countries have a livelihood and a future. What drives people out of their countries is the lack of hope. That's what drove my grandmother to this country 110 years ago.
Give me your dream vision of what comprehensive immigration reform would look like.
So first, it would start with a repair of the asylum system, which is thoroughly broken and now exploited by smuggling groups and irregular migrants themselves. Again, in the case of the latter, perhaps for understandable reasons. But when we look at the overall immigration system, the last comprehensive immigration reform we had was really during the Reagan years. And then we had a significant reform in the 1990s. Every 30 years we have in this country had a quite fundamental reform of the immigration laws, and we haven't had that. And I fear that we may have missed the opportunity given existing domestic political situation to have it in the foreseeable future. But actually at the beginning of the Obama administration's second term, the proposal that was crafted by the so-called Gang of Eight bipartisan group was actually quite good. Not perfect, but politics is not intended to achieve the perfect, but it was a comprehensive reform that addressed people who are here in this country in undocumented form, people who were seeking family reunification with relatives in this country. It addressed the high skill sector as well as the low skill occupations. It was quite a remarkable proposal that it was hammered out by Republicans and Democrats alike. And then, as we know, even though it would have passed the House if the Hastert rule, if the Republicans had freed their caucus to vote, you would have had a sufficient majority to pass in the House. But, you know, John Boehner, a very decent man, felt that he could not bring it out of the caucus. So he never permitted it to a vote. That was a turning point, I think, in this story.
And the chances of anything passing now, as you mentioned, because of the current political climate, probably nil.
For the foreseeable future, that's a fair assessment, Jean.
So talk about the intelligence side. If we're going to get smarter about seeing what's coming at us, who's coming at us, what kind of threat they pose, how does the intelligence about the border have to improve?
Well, first you'd need the political will to actually want to develop the kind of information that would affect, that would facilitate effective enforcement. There's a real question because of the divide in this country between immigration advocates and opponents, whether or not all of the rhetoric about needing to take down smuggling groups actually is genuine.
What do you mean?
Both the left and the right, the only thing they agree on is that, oh, these smugglers are miserable curs, and they are subjecting migrants to unaccountable atrocities, which they are, and we need to dismantle them. But we don't ever devote the resources and the effort to this, notwithstanding the creation of trafficking centers.
Because they're a convenient political foil, is that what you're saying?
They're a foil, but they also, you know, and here, looking at it from the advocacy community, in a very odd but perverse way, the smuggling groups, because we're now seeing migrants coming from not Mexico, contiguous to the United States, smuggling groups are absolutely essential to get people from the sending countries up to the U.S. border through Mexico. So there is a sense among some elements in the advocacy community that smugglers, for all of the evil they do, are in some sense an underground railway that provide relief for people who are fleeing intolerable circumstances in their homelands.
So we'll never see the intelligence about the border revamped either.
Not until we reach a consensus on a fair immigration system that permits people to apply and stay in queue and that effectively meets the labor demands in this country and the family reunification demands. As long as people feel that there is no other option in terms of legal pathways, I don't believe you'll see the political will to actually stop the smuggling. And therefore, without condoning the atrocities that are often committed, at the end of the day, without the smuggling groups, there would not be the migration on the scale that's taking place today.
Is this very frustrating for you?
Frustrating because it reflects our inability to actually revise the immigration laws in a way that would make this kind of hypocrisy, this kind of resort to smuggling groups, and now the involvement of transnational crime and the danger that it poses for migrants. Yes, it's frustrating that we cannot get to the root causes here, which is, we are the enemy because we cannot revise our laws to create a legal framework for the kind of migration that has made this country great.
What is the difference between human smuggling and human trafficking?
The smuggling organization's objective is to serve the client and meet his or her need to enter the United States, or at least present themselves so they can make a claim of asylum to U.S. officials. The trafficking organizations, on the other hand, are designed to exploit the migrants themselves, to impress them into labor gangs, or worse, into sex trafficking of women and men alike. So that there's the exploitation of the migrant that never serves the migrant's desire to get to the United States and join a family member, but rather there is a diversion of these individuals by organized crime involved in the human trafficking to get them involved in situations where they are exploited for sexual purposes or for labor purposes.
And should they be dealt with differently than the smugglers are?
In my mind, there's no question but that the priority should go to trafficking, to cut down on the organized criminal activity involved and the terror that's inflicted and horror that's inflicted on people. But we're at a situation now where the two forms of illegal activity, smuggling and trafficking, are still separate in my mind and my experience, but they're beginning to blur. And we need to deal with both of them. But if there were a priority, I would clearly turn to the trafficking dimension first, because that's where the greatest harm is being inflicted.
That was Alan Burson, former head of Customs and Border Protection. Burson currently is a senior fellow with the Belfer Center at Harvard's Kennedy School. He is also a global fellow at the Wilson Center and a senior advisor to the Covington and Burling law firm. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of Spy Talk. Remember to subscribe to Spy Talk on Substack, where you will find fresh reporting on all things intelligence-related from a cadre of top-notch reporters. And follow us on Twitter. Jeff Stein is at Spy Talker, and I'm Jean Meserve. It's been great to share this time with you. Bye-bye.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to SpyTalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Brian Karam, and I've spent decades covering politics. Now I'm taking you behind the scenes, one interview at a time.
Join us as each week Brian confronts the issues that matter, posing the questions you wish you could ask. No filter, no agenda, just the truth.
We're not here for sound bites. We're here for substance. Join me, Brian Karam, every week as we cut through the noise and get straight to it. This is Just Ask the Question, where curiosity will lead us to the facts.
Subscribe now on your favorite podcast platform. And remember, when you want answers, all you have to do is just ask the question.